Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. Lisa Anderson here with you, and I always like to give you a taste of what's coming up. So later on for our inbox, a guy is dating a girl at his church, but he is questioning if she is taking her faith seriously enough, and so he's unsure if she's worth pursuing. One of our counselors is going to give him some advice. And then for our culture segment, Kyle Mann, who's the editor-in-chief of the Christian satire website The Babylon Bee, is here to discuss how he balances faith with humor. So this will be a very, very good time that you will look forward to. That's coming up later. But here we are for our roundtable. And this is part two of our engagement stories roundtable. So if you didn't hear part one last week, that was when we talked to the guys about their perspective on engagements, proposals, what to do, what not to do. And today, this week, we are bringing in the ladies. And so I've got Laura, Catherine, and Jenny here. Hey, ladies.
Hey. Hello.
Wonderful. Wow, that was in unison. That was so nice. So
we've been practicing.
So, yeah, that was pretty good. All right. Well, we had a really fun time with the guys, and I was jokingly telling you ahead of time that you have a high bar because they were really fun and very honest. And so the first thing I want you guys to do is, as briefly as you can, because, you know, we only have a short segment, but as briefly as you can, tell us your specific proposal story. Like that day, how did it go down? Were you expecting it, not expecting it, and what actually happened?
This is Catherine. So obviously we're in Colorado. So Cody started by, my husband now started by taking me back to Missouri. And looking back, I feel like I sound like such a blonde, but I really didn't know what was happening. I thought he was probably going to ask my dad for permission in person, you know, like I figured that was what he was doing. We were just going on a weekend trip, like no big deal. So we drive to my parents' house and, or I think we flew actually, and we get there. And the next day we're going on a hike with my family. So we pull up at this nature preserve and my grandpa gets out of his car and he was like, "Ugh, I left my boat plugged in at the dock." Like very convincingly, way more convincingly than I just said that. Like 100% I believed him. And I was like, okay. So Cody was like, "Here, let me help you go plug your boat in." Again, like I totally should have known what was going on. But I was like, okay, bye guys. So we hiked for a while. Cody and Papa left. And I didn't know that Cody was setting a proposal on my grandparents' dock. So it started raining. We went back and he was like, "Hey, you want to go fish?" And so we walked down to the dock in the rain. It was very romantic. And he proposed there. There was music playing, candles. And then the second surprise was that I had gotten pretty close to his sister at that point. And she like popped up out of a boat in the dock and I like screamed and I was like, "What are you doing here?" And his parents had driven in secretly. So all of our families went back to the lake house and like had a seafood dinner and it was perfect.
Oh, fun. Okay.
So this is Laura. We actually started planning the wedding before we got engaged and it got to the point where we sent our save the dates before we got engaged. Because I was like, okay, this wedding's in 3 months. We need to tell people that it's happening. But basically, Brent wanted to surprise me and he didn't know how to surprise me since everything was already happening and I already knew that this was, you know, a thing. And so the day he got the ring, he texted my roommate and he asked her, "When is a good time to do this, that Laura, me, is going to be out of the house for a little bit, but then back home at a somewhat reasonable hour?" Because I spend a lot of time volunteering at my church.
That's what she calls it. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So it turned out that that night was the only night that he could do it, or else he'd have to wait like 2 more weeks to propose to me. And so my roommate and I went to a movie and we came home and there was a rubber duck left on the door handle of our house. And I picked it up and I turned around to her and be like, "Oh, look, he couldn't make it to the movie. So he came and just left this rubber duck. Why are you filming me?" And she goes, she like tries to hide her phone. She's like, "I'm not filming you. I don't know what you're talking about." So I walked in the house and I knew at that point what was happening. And there was a note telling me to go up the stairs. And up the stairs, he had left little memories of our dating life together and little notes about how much he loved doing all these things with me. And when I got to the top of the stairs, there was a note that said, "Go back downstairs." And he had been hiding in the half bathroom on the first floor of my house. And he had found every single candle in my house and put it on the kitchen table and lit it while I was walking up the stairs. And he was waiting there with the ring and he proposed.
Awesome. Aww.
So this is Jenny. I have to say that this is going to be my confessional because I don't think anybody knows this, but I definitely knew this was coming. I snuck upstairs when Blakely called my dad and opened the window. This is terrible. But I was 20, so I feel like maybe there's a little, you know, young. She didn't know. And so I definitely knew it was happening. Well, so my husband was military.
He lived in England. Wait, you opened the window. What was the story?
Like to listen.
Oh.
Because they were out on the back deck. Thank you. I didn't explain that part. Yeah, so the dad was out on the back deck on the phone.
Oh, man.
And so I was like, this is probably it. So I went up and opened the window, and I was like, listening.
You're also the one that opened all your gifts before Christmas, right?
No.
And then rewrapped them?
That.
Okay.
I'm a weirdo. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I think it was just this was like, this better be happening or I'm going to be upset. And so I had a trip coming up to go see him in England because he was stationed there at the time. And so I went and I guess there was this whole debacle with he was intending for his mom to pick up the ring at the jeweler and then hide it in my luggage. But that never happened for some reason. So they mailed it and it got there. He was going to propose in Heathrow Airport. That was like the moral of the story, like as I came. And he couldn't because he basically got a call from whoever is that in England saying, we're holding your ring until you come pay like this huge fine, like customs fine.
No.
So this was back in 08 when the exchange rate was like terrible. So they were like, you owe us £500, which was $1,000 back then, just to get it.
Oh, no.
So he had to go do that. And anyway, he had to make up this like makeshift proposal, which was still great, but it was a scavenger hunt. Which I'm thinking in my mind, like, what if he had forgotten where one of the things was? That would be not great. But it was a scavenger hunt and he was playing music as well. And then by the time it got to like each card had like a word on it. And by the time it got to like, will you? I was like, all right, well, we know what the other three are. We should just like find those three. So because I know what they say. And then, yeah, he proposed and the ring didn't fit. It was a whole debacle.
Wow.
But
wow.
Here we are 12 years later. So,
well, and here is really the good news. Jenny, you were worth at least $1,000.
At least. This might be cubic zirconia, but I was worth at least that.
So he didn't abandon ship. He didn't scrap the whole plan. It's good.
Yeah.
Got it done.
Yeah,
so,
that's
all
true.
Right. Let's talk more generally now, because I think guys who are listening want to know from you, what are some of the do's and don'ts of a proposal? Like if you had to give advice about, you know, and it could be from your own planning or stories, it could be friends' stories that you've heard, just when you hear of like things that are awesome versus things that are like, eh, what would you say?
Well, I would suggest getting engaged before you send the save the dates. It takes a long time to plan a wedding. And even if you're having a small wedding, if you want a venue, you need to book it really early in advance or you're mm-hmm. not going to be able to get the date that you want or even any Saturday at all. Mm. So plan on proposing with enough time that you can actually plan the wedding afterwards. So that's my advice.
Yeah. I would say what I loved about Laura's was that her husband totally went by who Laura is. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's exactly what Cody did for me. So I think don't worry about the wow factor or, mm-hmm. you know, expensive or things that you see in movies or, you know, whatever. You know the girl that you're going to marry and you know why you love her and you know about your relationship. Go based on that. So whatever your thing is. So I think one of the guys told the story about proposing on a hike. Like if that's your thing, propose on a hike. I would say worry less about wowing or being perfect and just do it based on who the girl is and what she'll like. And I think you'll know. And I mean, she's not going to hate it. I promise. She'll never, I've never ever met a girl who was like, I hated how he proposed. Yeah. It's always perfect, no matter what happens. The other thing is, don't worry about having a speech prepared.
Yeah.
I guess Cody had a long speech prepared that he'd been practicing in his head. And at the moment, he like got down on his knees. He's looking at me with his blue eyes. And he was like, and he was like, you're the love of my life and my best friend. Will you marry me? And he was like, I'm sorry. Like afterwards, he was like, I was going to say so much more. I was like, that was perfect. That was the perfect mm-hmm. thing to say. Like that was, you could not have said any better. So I would say you know, if this, you've really prayed about this relationship and this engagement and this girl, you know what to do. And don't worry, she will love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of our guys last week had written a song that he promptly forgot when it came yeah. to the proposal.
Of course, of course.
That was kind of a bust. But.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Yeah. I was going to say that I think most women now, they don't want that public display. It seems like most women want that private moment. So yeah, it doesn't have to be like on the kiss cam at the baseball game, like when COVID goes away, or, you know, something that is this huge big deal, because then it's just kind of feels awkward and like a performance for everybody else. But when it can just be that moment, just the two of you, or filming, mm-hmm. you know, the random other people that are hiding, usually it seems like nowadays, yeah. I think it feels a lot more special because yeah, we do tend to want something that feels personalized to us and not, you know, a yeah. ransom of $1,000 to
well, I'd
get
always
the ring.
Also say, like, expect things to go wrong, like they did with that mm-hmm. ring.
Right.
So one of my friends, they were going to a rodeo. You know, this shows you I have country friends. So they're going to a rodeo.
I'm like, what's that?
And she, like, got sick. I don't know. I don't exactly remember what happened, but it was horrible. And so they went home, and he was like, I don't know what to do. And so he, like, walked into her room. She was laying upside down across her bed. You know how girls do that? Like laying their head down, mm-hmm. upside down. And she had her arms stretched out, and he just put the ring on her hand, on her, in her room. And she was like, it was perfect. It was so Aww. Me. And like, it's just more memorable when things go wrong. Like, yeah. that's what makes a good story.
Right.
Yeah. Which is a good thing to say and remind people, because I think now in this era, we talked about this last week too, of flash mobs and crazy like videographers showing right. up and choirs and stuff like that. Not, you know, I gave the advice last week of do not even attempt a flash mob unless you have got like full on orchestras behind you, choreographed dancers, because you can't live up to the hype on YouTube.
Have you
stuff.
Seen the flash mob surprise proposal and surprise wedding? That is too much.
No. Yeah.
That is
no.
too much.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, all these people that are getting like celebrities to show up at their proposals and stuff. I'm just like, I would be so freaked out. I mean, it's just hilarious. So, yeah, I don't know. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, then you can't say no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, true.
I mean, I obviously yeah. want to be optimistic here, but as the therapist, it's like, please don't enter something that you don't want to enter. So
yes.
I think having that privacy of being like, are we ready? Or is this something we really want to do? Obviously, that's like that's a killer. But at the same time, I think that's important to have that privacy, because it's like, it's a big deal.
Having those conversations before you actually propose can help too.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, true. That's a question I was going to ask, and maybe Laura, you can start by answering this. Is the element of surprise wanted or necessary, or were you guys like, this would not have gone well if I was not sure I wanted to marry this guy, and or we had talked about it, and or because again, the whole fantasy thing is, it just came out of the blue. I didn't even know, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But clearly there's planning to be done. Clearly you want to be sure that you actually want to marry this guy. You don't want to make his feelings hurt. You know, I personally, perhaps I'm the only one here, I've been part of a failed proposal. It was super lame. And I remember thinking in my head, I now am going to be part of a failed proposal. And this is just sad mm-hmm. and lame. And I remember thinking to myself, well, should I just say yes and hopefully we'll work it out, you know, so that, and I'm glad I didn't. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, what details did you want to know? Did you want to know this was coming? Did you want to know? Did you script what the ring should be like? How much recon did you give on the front end?
So I would say that if he proposes to you and you guys have never talked about it before, that's
not
a good sign you're going to have some communication issues
good.
In your
yes.
marriage.
Yeah.
We had gone ring shopping before. We had talked about it. I knew that we were getting engaged. And like I said, we had already booked the venue. I had bought the dress. Yeah, I would say that if you genuinely don't know that it's coming, that you're probably not quite ready to get married, or at least you need to make communication a major focus of your premarital counseling.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I honestly don't think in this day and age, with all the resources that we have, it should be a surprise. That doesn't sound very romantic, but I mean, we had gone through pre-engagement counseling. We had talked to multiple couples. We had mm-hmm. prayed. And I mean, really, like Laura said, I mean, you can surprise in terms of like, you don't know what night it'll happen. Mm-hmm. You don't know
right.
how exactly.
Yeah. And that can be fun.
Oh, yeah, totally. But yeah, I think you need to talk about it. It needs to be like, you know, it's coming. Otherwise, there's definitely a communication issue. As far as the ring, I think that's different for everyone. I have friends who had totally picked out their ring, like had Pinterest boards going, you know, all that stuff. I wasn't that way. I didn't know. And we started talking kind of to my parents about the possibility of getting engaged. And my mom was like, I have some things you might want to use. And she gave Cody my grandma's old diamond. Mm. And so that was cool. And then he ended up using that to make my ring. And he kind of showed me like some different options. He's like, do you like this? Do you like this? But ultimately, I wanted him to pick it out. That was kind of important to me. But I think, again, like Laura said, it's a communication thing. So ask about the ring. Like, don't be afraid to be like, do you want to pick out your own ring or do you want me to? Because I think it's just the more you talk about it, the better.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. All right. Well, kind of the final question I want to ask is a more serious one, and that is about the timing of a proposal, specifically like the big rocks that need to be in place. So I think some people, for example, you know, and I would say I would discourage this idea of like, I had a friend who basically dated for 8 years because they wanted to save up for such a big wedding and make this big event that they put that on hold. I mean, it was just crazy. But that said, what did you need to know before you knew you could be confident moving towards engagement? And maybe what are a couple things that people way stress out about or things that aren't as important in a relationship that people are holding onto and not moving forward with, things that you'd be like, just chill out, don't worry about that?
Yeah, I think for us it was interesting because we got married so young, and I don't necessarily say that that's for everybody. The reason why it worked well for us was a lot of the things were in place that people want to be in place. So there was a stable, guaranteed income, at least by one of us, health insurance, you know, all of these things that, you know, people are like, well, I need to get this and this and this and this in place. And so for us, that seemed to make the most sense. It's like we have this guaranteed support where it's like, even if he's injured, guess what? He still gets a paycheck. Like, that's the way the military works. You get paid on the 1st and the 15th, no matter what. And so I think that a lot of that is dependent on the decision-making process for a lot of people is we want to have those finances in place, or we want to have, you know, those big things in place where it's like we feel stable. So I think that the answer would be whatever stability looks like for you. What are those big important things? And that goes back to what Catherine and Laura were already saying as far as communication, like what needs to happen, what needs to be in place in order to feel like we can move forward in a way that makes sense. And that's not really age dependent. That's maturity dependent and just life stage dependent.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I kind of like made some notes here. I think there's three things you have to be sure about and then three that people often overthink. So you have to be sure about his relationship with Christ. Mm-hmm. Does he love God? Does he follow God? Is he growing? And I think Jim Daly said the other day, are you students in the same class? Like if God was teaching classes, would you be in the same class? I liked that because I felt like that's how Cody and I were. And I think family was really important to me, not so much that I think I'll never have issues with his family or him with mine, but that he loves his family and respects his family, and that where his family looks is where I could see our family going, because I think that's the best reflection of, you know, who he's going to be as an adult is probably a lot like his dad, stuff like that. The third thing, I think you need to struggle with them, and I think you need to have fun with them. I think if you get engaged before you've had a single fight or a single hard thing you've gone through, then you maybe should wait a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, because life will bring you something. We had a conflict the first summer we were dating. It was really hard. It was embarrassing for me. I felt like my whole trying to, you know, let him know that I came from a good Christian family kind of got warped. And I was like, is he going to stay with me? What is he going to think of my family? What are we going to do? And the respect and trust that we built through that summer really helped me be confident. But then I think have fun, laugh. Do you laugh? Do you talk? Do you love being around that person? Because if you do, it just gets better. If you need breaks from them every once in a while, I would say that's a red flag. Real quick, the three things I think people overthink are money, having a plan, and your age. So, like Jenny said, you need stability, but you don't need to be millionaires. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to get rid of all your debt. You can do that faster together than you can apart. Cody and I paid off his truck the very first year of our marriage. You don't need to have a plan. You don't need to know exactly what you're doing in life or where you're going. And if you really have all those things in place, your age, I think doesn't really matter mm-hmm. whether mm-hmm. he's younger than you or it's a weird situation like that or you're on the older side or the younger side like Jenny. I think, you know, you just need to not worry about what other people think, but really just hone in and say, God, like, what do you want for this relationship? I surrender this to you. And I will do what you want. And God will make it clear to you, like, should you move forward or should you not? I really think he will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would just say, do you feel that you can be more effective for God together than apart?
Yep.
So, yeah. Like, my husband works in video, and he wants to make movies someday that will teach how God wants us. I'm doing a bad job of explaining this, but be an example of how God wants us to live our lives. But he didn't have a lot of experience in audio. And my job, my degree is in audio production. So that was clear to us that together we can be more effective than we could be on our own. And I think a lot of people just kind of see, oh, this is my opportunity to be loved and, you know, have the family and everything that I want. But how is that going to make you more effective for God's kingdom? And
yeah.
I think it's important that you know that you're okay being on your own and you're okay in yourself. You don't need the other person to complete you before you get married. Because if you're two complete people and you can be okay by yourself, you'll be better together
mm-hmm.
and you won't be trying to get that from the other person. Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole point of marriage. I mean, mm-hmm. the whole point of marriage to me, mm-hmm. I tell people, when they call here on the phones, they say there's three purposes of marriage. One is to receive influence from one another, that iron sharpens iron mentality, and two are better than one. And so really, that's why we have marriage on the side of heaven, and that's why marriage is not eternal, because it's not needed in heaven. It's needed here because we're human and we're fallible. And so that to me is the whole point of, like, what can we do together that's furthering the kingdom? And the companionship is obviously a bonus, but that's not really the whole point.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, ladies, this is great advice. And hopefully those of you women and men who are listening can weigh in and what really resonated with you. What additional questions do you have? Let's bring it on to social media. We can talk about it there and hopefully keep the conversation going. So, ladies, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Folks, we're here for this week's culture segment, and today's going to be a fun one, or I'm just saying that, whatever. I'm assuming it's going to be fun because I have got Kyle Mann. He's editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee, and you guys, many of you read this. Many of you, we've seen your memes and your retweets of what's going on over at the Bee. And so, Kyle, welcome to the Boundless Show.
Yeah, this will be a fun one, I hope.
Well, that all rests on you. This is, which is hilarious.
It's a lot because of pressure.
It's funny because it's one of those things where I'm sure maybe 7, 8, 9 times a day you get like, okay, Kyle, say something funny or do something funny. You're like the pull a rabbit out of your hat guy when it comes to comedy, probably. So, sorry
all
about that. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, your life is just one big guffaw, I'm sure. Well, awesome. Well, obviously, you have friends here at the Boundless Show and in our audience, but we thought we would kind of peek in a little bit and talk to you about some of your background as well as what's going on right now. Obviously, we're in a very interesting slash intense slash insane era in especially in American culture right here where we are, and you guys are certainly capitalizing on it, which is awesome. So but anyway, just a little background on you. Like I said, you are editor-in-chief at the Babylon Bee. You started out writing for them specifically, and I kind of want to get the scoop on that, but you studied a few years at Masters in Southern California. You are married. You used to work in construction and work in a local church. And so obviously that has played into a lot of what you do and provides fodder for looking into the headlines and commenting on them. So so I want to kind of kick it off by saying, first of all, if you had to do, you know, I mean, for the two people probably that are listening that haven't read your stuff, give the Babylon Bee elevator speech. So this is, now I don't know if you've had, like, is it, did you have to have this conversation with like a grandparent about like, I'm actually doing, this is a real job, like this is what we do, or what would you say to explain to someone who's like, literally tell me what this is about, what do you do, what is this paper?
Yeah, I mean, I have to have that conversation with myself all the time and assure myself that this is a real job. 'Cause I just write jokes on the internet, and it's pretty fantastic. But yeah, so the Babylon Bee is a Christian satire site, a Christian news satire site. So we write satire. It's framed like real news, but is obviously absurd and over the top, and is commenting on current events, things that happen in the church, everyday life, and all done in the style of a news reporter. So it's like there's a news reporter in your church or in your house commenting on the yeah. on the things that are going on. We do politics, we do religion, we do current events, just goofy stuff we see every day in the crazy time of 2020 and everything that we're living through right now. Yeah. So that's pretty much it. You know, it's the Christian version of The Onion, if you're familiar mm-hmm. with The Onion, so that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's funny, as you were saying that, I was like, oh yeah, okay, Lisa, your background is, my background and my degree is in journalism. I worked in Washington, D.C. for a while on a magazine and newspaper there. And what's hilarious is I remember going and sitting in writers' meetings where you didn't know one day if you were going to get fired, you were going to get cussed out. I had editors who were conspiracy theorists, and I'm like, maybe this is a little bit of a slice of what it's like to do satire in a way. Sometimes I felt like I was maybe working at the Babylon Bee. So that's pretty awesome. Okay. Well, you started there by writing a piece that the founder of the Bee asked you to write. Tell us, what was the topic of that?
Yeah, I wrote, so the day the Babylon Bee launched, I was following Adam Ford on Facebook. He posted kind of a call for submissions, just people to send in emails with headlines. And he got sent thousands of submissions like in that first couple of days. It was it was insane. Just there was a kind of an outpouring. But I think the site really hit kind of a need or a void in the market for comedy that made fun of Christians, but not in a hateful way, from someone on the inside, made fun of conservative issues, but not from the perspective of someone who hates conservatives, and made fun of some of the ideas that we see on the left or in the center that we felt needed to be ridiculed. So I saw the post, and I was just a fan of Adam Ford's old reformed webcomic that he drew. So I immediately fired off something that just popped into my head, which was Holy Spirit unable to move through congregation as fog machine breaks.
Okay.
And I sent it off and wrote the copy, and the next day he published it. And that was, you know, I was amazed on Facebook. You know, it was getting thousands of shares, and it was incredible because I'm just kind of speaking to my own experience. I wasn't trying to write anything. You know, you're not trying to write a big viral hit. You're just trying to write something that's authentic, you know, with your own experiences, and it really resonated with a lot of churchgoers.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and it's funny. I mean, I know just even today I was going through your homepage and was cracking up, and have cracked up probably two or three times since, of one of the current headlines that is Republicans nervous Roe v. Wade could be overturned, eliminating any reason to vote for them, which
is pretty great. And it brings me to the point of you're kind of, I mean, maybe not totally equal opportunity when it comes to fundamentalists versus progressives, but you try to do a pretty good job of there's something in it for everyone as far as like, really, we got to be able to laugh at a bunch of stuff that's out there. How do you kind of go about deciding, like, I mean, I know you obviously follow the news, but how do you decide like, oh yeah, this one's going to work or this isn't?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors to consider. And, you know, there's different aims and there's a different purpose for every piece. You know, not every piece needs to be this big viral hit, and, you know, not every piece needs to speak to this current event. You can do stuff that's more timeless. You can do more niche articles that that not a ton of people are going to get, but, you know, the people that do get it are going to love it. You know, so we do try to do a good mix of politics, everyday life, religion, that kind of stuff. If we're going to do a current event, I just kind of look around the internet and make sure the joke hasn't been done before, make sure it's the angle we want to do, make sure enough people know what the current event is that you're referencing. You know, balance in terms of making fun of the left and the right, that is something we consider. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing if your site is 100% balance, you know, like mm-hmm. we won't like make fun of Democrats for every time you make fun of Republicans or, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever. I do think your site needs to have a unique voice and an angle, and it's okay to kind of have a worldview that you're writing from. But I think if you're willing to make fun of the other side, you do need to be willing to make fun of your own side and to call out hypocrisy, especially mm-hmm. In your own side. And I think that shows a strength of satire. It shows kind of authenticity. It gives the site character. And I like the fact that our readers can never feel 100% safe.
Yeah.
You know, because they know that that they may be laughing now, but the next post may poke them in the eye.
Yeah. So you may have to slay a couple assumptions here, but tell us what this actually looks like the process of your, I mean, people are envisioning like, you know, all you guys gathered around a table, pencils behind your ear, like a huge, quote, newsroom of folks that are like, okay, let's all, you know, pitch our ideas and put the stories out there. What does it actually look like in truth, especially now during a pandemic, of how you guys are feeding the beast each day?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty incredible for the reach that we had. The first couple years of the site was just basically me and Adam working in our basements type thing. Mm-hmm. Although I live in Southern California, so I don't have a basement, but I guess I was in my garage. But, you know, we were just working kind of solo. We had some writers that would pitch some ideas in a Facebook group, but we wrote the bulk of the content for a couple of years. More recently, we've been able to kind of expand and have a legit operation with a few more employees that help us out. In terms of, like, writing the jokes, a lot of it we just do kind of in a group chat. A lot of our writers are scattered across the country. You know, even before the pandemic, we were all remote anyway. So that was kind of how we did it. We are building a little bit of a local team here in Southern California. We have 3 or 4 creative writers down here that will come in for writers' meetings so we can all sit down and pitch ideas for articles. We're working on a lot of animation on our YouTube channel. So we'll write sketches for animation and that kind of stuff. So yeah, there is that little bit of a writer's room thing that we're building up, but for the most part, you know, it's been pretty remote and it's kind of unglamorous a lot of the time. You know, it's me sitting at my computer just praying for an idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. It's comforting to know that you pray, Kyle. We're glad. We're glad to hear it. You're not just like, you didn't just Google Christianity and be like, okay, what can I say about these guys? Okay. To that point, give us a little picture of yourself. I mean, not, you know, not necessarily like you sitting at a computer doing whatever, but your background kind of influences, like I'm assuming you have both comedic influences plus faith influences. What does that look like for you? Because I'm assuming, you know, to my opening point of like everyone just thinking of you one-dimensionally, I mean, the fact is, if you're a Christian, you've got to have an active, robust faith. And what does that actually look like in day-to-day life?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I try to start every day with, you know, some reading the scriptures, reading the Psalms. You know, I think especially a day where, or in a job where I have to like write about current events and make fun of things and, you know, take a stand on this or that, it's I think it's important to kind of ground ourselves in eternity before we get the day going. And the news is such a fast-paced 24-hour cycle that that it's easy to lose sight of what's important and to think that this crisis that, you know, the crisis that we're talking about today is so important. And we forget that there's like a wider sweep of history and that there's a there are things that are important and that transcend these little tiny culture war fights that we're in every day. So, you know, as far as that goes, yeah, you know, I'll try to read the scriptures every morning before I log on, the Psalms especially. My, you know, theological influences, I grew up in a mega church, you know, that was fairly a standard kind of middle of the road evangelical. You know, learned the gospel, accepted Christ, saw that stuff, but there wasn't really a strong conviction about the gospel or about the word of God. And I stumbled into that later, like in my college years, and I ended up going to Bible college and learning a lot there. And then, yeah, I did help pastor a Southern Baptist church for several years. I co-pastored a Southern Baptist church down in San Diego before I quit all my other stuff to do the Babylon Bee full time. So I kind of had, you know, I think all of that feeds into the comedic experience, because it's, you know, the being in a small church is such a funny thing that all of us people who have been in small churches can relate to. And it's the same thing with the mega church. You know, it's like a whole different culture. So I think since I've bounced around to a couple of different styles of churches, that's helped. You know, it's all kind of prepared me to be able to write comedy about the church. You know, comedic influences. I love really dry stuff like mockumentaries. You know, This Is Spinal Tap and Best mm-hmm. in Show and that kind of stuff. That's just very like very dry, which fits perfectly with the kind of stuff we do at the Babylon Bee, because we don't point out the joke. You know, we just kind of dryly report on the absurdity, and so that's kind of fed into that, I guess, and maybe prepared me to be able to write that kind of dry satire.
Yeah. I had a PTSD-ish moment there of dating a guy a while back who every reference that he made, I think, came from This Is Spinal Tap, including multiple references per week to the It Goes to 11. So I'm going to just calm down from that and be okay with it. We'll move on. It's all good. But it's funny because I would imagine that there is probably some element of you having to be careful as what will people even understand? I mean, do you find that sadly maybe some biblical illiteracy kind of creates a problem for you as far as like you can only go so far with like certain doctrinal, you know, I mean, how much can you say about Calvin or about the, you know, the First Great Awakening without people being like, what? Just give me a latte. You know, I'm just trying to, I just want to love Jesus. So, but I'm sure you poke fun at that too.
Right. And so that gets factored in when we write a joke. Like if we know that a particular joke is going to be very narrow. Gosh, I think our narrowest joke was probably, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Amaraldians, which are four-point Calvinists.
Okay, yeah.
Amaraldian College loses basketball game by 1 point or something, or loses basketball game 5-4.
Okay.
You know.
Wow.
And it's like, yeah, it probably got, you know, five people shared it on social media or something. But the people who got it loved it, you know, like, I can't believe you published this joke. So, you know, this is hilarious. So I think that we do factor that in. I mean, you know, if we're going to do something that's for a wider audience, for a political audience, the people that follow us for politics, and we're going to do a Bible reference, we know that it has to be something more recognizable. You know, you got to do something that connected to the flood or Moses or, you know, something like that. So yeah, we do take that into account, but I know I think it's fine to write a joke that five people are going to get. You know, sometimes I write one that only I laugh at, and that's all right.
That's okay. Well, that's good, because I would say I'm pretty much a Calvinist, I guess, but maybe it's because I'm a 4.5 pointer.
Yeah, 4.5. Yeah,
I didn't even know that term. I was like, what you just said, the Amaraldian. I'm like, okay, wow, all right.
You have to fact check me, but I think that's right.
That's good. All right. So what, you know, just looking at where we are right now, coming off of, you know, a spring and a summer of COVID, I mean, there's everything hits the news. In fact, we were talking about this at Boundless and the things that we've covered. I mean, we went through racism. We went through Pride Month. We did cancel culture. You know, now we're getting into the election and stuff. What, when you look at the church, Kyle, what specifically encourages you and what discourages you? What, I mean, how does that look for you personally?
Yeah, from the church, I'm encouraged by the fact that my generation tends to be, maybe this is anecdotal, but my generation tends to be a little more passionate about taking a stand for doctrine, returning to traditions, where I think the previous generation, or maybe a couple generations back, you know, kind of my parents' generation was more like very pro mega church, pro seeker sensitive. You know, we need to kind of get the message out and be cool and build our churches to look like shopping malls and that kind of stuff. And I feel like, you know, everything's always a pendulum. It swings back and forth. And it's an encouraging trend that I think a lot of my generation sees right through that. You know, we demand some authenticity from things, from the church. And so I know a lot of people that I grew up with, like in a mega church, ended up just being very solid doctrinally despite that upbringing, you know, because they rebelled against that. They said, we want truth. You know, we want to know what the Bible says. Mm-hmm. And we don't care if it makes us look uncool or whatever. Like, we want someone to tell us that it's okay to stand for something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really encouraging. On the discouraging side, you know, I'm discouraged by the way that the prosperity gospel has infiltrated a lot of mainstream churches and morphed into kind of a more palatable form. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it used to be that you could look at a prosperity gospel preacher, you know, who was on the TV and asking you to send in hundreds of dollars, and you could kind of tell right away, like, this guy's a fraud. And the wider culture made fun of those guys, and the church made fun of those guys. And yeah, they still deceive a lot of people, but I think a lot of us, you know, can instantly recognize that as something bad. Mm-hmm. But there's kind of a more insidious version of the prosperity gospel where you have the cool preacher in the nice shoes and he's got cool hair and he speaks really well, and he doesn't necessarily flaunt his wealth or drive around in the Lamborghini. But I think those kind of positive self-help messages that you're enough and you can do it and you can reach inside yourself and find the power without Jesus, you know, that mm-hmm. Jesus-less gospel is a lot more dangerous, I think, than some of the previous forms of the prosperity gospel. But, you know, at the Babylon Bee, that's what we're trying to do, is
right.
shine a light on that kind of stuff. So
yeah. Well, and really the companion to that, I mean, you know, beyond the overt prosperity kind of stuff, but just the whole, like, let's pick and choose the things in scripture that no longer mm-hmm. we're comfortable with. And so we're going to just, you know, it's either going to be some milquetoast, you know, mommy blogging it out of the scriptures, or people abandoning the faith and just pulling everyone with them because they've got a great Instagram following. And so, hey, let's see what I'm doing now. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's like serious stuff wrapped up in a way of like, okay, how are we going to talk about this? It's nuts.
Right.
Yeah. All right. We're seriously hoping, I got to make a note to myself, like, make sure Boundless never becomes the subject of a Babylon Bee headline. How do we, we'll have to put that up in our office, I guess, make sure how to handle that. Okay. Talk to us a little bit about the recent ban on Twitter, which I understand was just kind of a little dust up because they did apologize and say, oh, we identified you as spam. Sorry, our bad. But it was a little bit, you know, I mean, were you kind of like, what? You know, did it cause you to take pause?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't end up hurting us at all. In fact, it was really good for us because a lot of people showed their support by subscribing to the Babylon Bee and following us. You know, we gained, I don't know, 150,000 Twitter followers and a lot of subscribers to our website. So it ended up working out, but yeah, basically what happened is Twitter suspended us for a few hours, with not much explanation and no real way to to contest it. Mm-hmm. And they did this to multiple comedy accounts. Specifically, it seemed to be ones that targeted the left with satire or humor or memes and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And our account got reinstated pretty quickly. And I think that was because we did have so many people tweeting, you know, there was a hashtag save the bee and all this. And, you know, we have really good fans that supported us through that. But some of the other accounts took a long time to get put back up, you know, up to weeks. So that's concerning to us that there's a social media network, you know, and that's how we reach our fans for the most part. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can just at the press of a button turn off everything that you've built up. You know, so that's some cause for concern. I don't want to make it sound like, oh, we're being persecuted for, mm-hmm. you know, there's kind of a persecution complex thing that a lot of conservatives and Christians sometimes have about social media, and that's not the tone that I want to strike. But it is concerning whether you're on the left or the right or whatever that you know that these social media companies do have. Mm-hmm. So much power. So that is why we launched a subscription service where people will come on our website and they'll pay us, you know, $5 a month or something to just kind of show their support. And you know, we get rid of ads and there's some exclusive premium content for them. And that was an intentional decision on our part when we launched that a year and a half ago, because we're looking at our traffic numbers and we're going, you know, if Facebook bans us or Twitter bans us, and we've gotten into death steps with them, both of those outlets several times, and if they ban us, it's like, okay, you know, that's going to turn off 90% of our traffic or whatever, and that, you don't want all your eggs in that basket. So so that's kind of why we've done that with the subscriptions. And you know, yeah, this time it worked out, but next time it might not. So yeah, it is something that worries us a bit.
Yeah. Okay, just in the last, you know, minute that we have here, any, I would imagine that you have in the back of your mind, or maybe you'll have to think about this, but just unexpected mentions or fans, reader comments, public rebukes that you've received. What just comes to mind is like, you got up, you checked your inbox, or you checked a feed somewhere, and it's like, oh my goodness, so-and-so saw our article, or why are they, you know, why is this person like telling us we're, you know, I'm not saved because I published XYZ? Just anything that stands out as being especially nutty or bizarre?
So we get hate mail all the time, like, and you wouldn't believe, you know, how harmless an article can seem, and somebody gets really upset, like, oh, you shouldn't make fun of, you know, puppies. Puppies are off limits, or, you know, or whatever it is we're writing an article about. And it happens on the left and the right. There's not really it's not like one side is snowflakes and the other side isn't snowflakes. It's like, yeah, both sides get really upset when you tip over their sacred cow. Actually, one cool one that happened was, we wrote an article about Keith and Kristen Getty. Mm-hmm. What was the article? It was they're struggling to find a rhyme for substitutionary atonement.
Okay. Yeah.
And the next day, I check social and they've tagged us, and so Keith and Kristen Getty actually wrote a song.
Oh, that's great.
Based on that article, where they're doing all these rhymes for substitutionary atonement, and it was,
yeah,
it was fantastic, you know. And it was one of those articles where, you know, only a few people shared the article because it's, you know, it's not that widespread. It's a small, yeah, target, that kind of stuff. But when I saw that, I was like, this is just perfect. And that kind of made my life. So,
yeah. Okay. So I actually know them, and she is just as sweet as she seems, like, anywhere.
Oh,
she's just like the nicest person. Okay, Keith, not so much. Like, he's actually pretty hilarious and very sarcastic. And he actually promised me, hey, Keith, if you're listening, and never came through, to put a flute solo in for me to play in one of their songs on an album. And let's just say he dropped the ball on that. So anyway, we were supposed to do a, you know, an Irish Celtic flute piano jam. So, Keith, whatever, step forward. All right. Well, Kyle, this has been really fun. I appreciate you checking in with us and just giving us a little behind the scenes of the Babylon Bee. Folks, we obviously will have a link to the site. But again, as we've been talking to Kyle, you know, again, get out there, read their stuff, subscribe, let people know, share. You know, I mean, it really is. God uses a lot of things in a lot of different ways to spread truth, to encourage people, to provide a laugh. And so this is definitely one of them. So Kyle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun. Your promise was true. It was fun.
Yay, awesome. You hold my every moment. You calm my raging seas. You walk with me through fire and heal. Well, we are going to finish out the show with our inbox, as we often do, and we're bringing in Tim Sanford, one of our counselors here at Focus on the Family. Hey, Tim.
Good to be here, Lisa.
Awesome. All right. Well, here is this week's question. One of our guys says, I recently got into a dating relationship with a girl who goes to my church. After 5 weeks of getting to know her in a group setting, I asked her on a date. We had the define the relationship conversation on the second date. That weekend, I talked to her about faith and how I see God as the center of my life. When I asked her about it, she said she wasn't there yet. I didn't ask her more then, but it troubled me, and I now have a lot of questions. She's a facilitator for her community group, has been going to the same church for 4 years, and serves in the nursery. So I was surprised by her answer. Should I be concerned? I want to talk to her more about it and not drop the relationship on a whim, but I'm having doubts if she's worth pursuing.
Well, Lisa, I struggle with a couple phrases here. The God is the center of my life, and she isn't there yet. So that those are just too vague and cliche-ish for me. I mean, for me, the Christian life is not a destination. So it's not someplace you arrive at. It's a journey. I've been a follower of Jesus for 40 years. I'm ordained as a minister. And I'm not even bold enough to say that I'm there, wherever that is, just yet. So my Christian faith is an ongoing daily journey. So I don't know if that's just me or what's going on. The other part is that can kind of come across a little prideful sounding. I don't know that he had meant it that way. She might, though, take it that way of, I've arrived and you haven't yet. So I think the first suggestion that I have, Lisa, is for the listener to really think deeply about those phrases and what he then means when he uses those phrases. So that's where I'd start. As far as the relationship, at least the girl is honest with you. That you got to be appreciative of, okay? I mean, she could have given a nice little cliche answer of, yeah, you know, I love Jesus too. That's the sarcastic preacher's kidding me coming out, Lisa, you know
okay,
that.
Okay, yeah.
But her I'm not there yet may have several different reasons. Let me give you a few of them. One is, even though she's involved in these different things, her individual connectedness with God may not be all that real or deep. I mean, that's possible. Another possibility here is that the reason she's not there yet, and I get stuck on that phrase, okay, is because she's either working on or she needs to work on some personal life issues. God can't be paramount in her life just yet. She's going in that direction. She's just not there yet. So maybe that's what she means. It could also be that God is real to her, and she's a deep thinker. So she's aware of her relationship with God, and that could be deeper. It could be more centered. It could be more, how do you want to say it, center instead of kind of like a shopping thing. And she knows she's not there yet. So it's deep. It's real. She's not totally accurate believing that she's there and doesn't want to pretend that she is. So that's another possibility that I'm thinking of. So my suggestion to this guy is find out more. Mm-hmm. Ask her, see what her responses are and the reasons behind those responses. It may be a deal breaker for her. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. He may find out, though, that she's a person worth continuing to pursue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Yeah, it's interesting. It's so, you know, it's hard for us to understand because we weren't there for the conversation. We don't know, you know, where she was going with that. But yeah, I mean, if it's clear that she was like, you know, yeah, I don't really think I have totally bought into the whole Jesus thing yet, or I don't think I, you know, but I like going to church because I have friends here. You know, that's a different story than, yeah, I really still have doubts in my faith, or I'm struggling, or I'm trying to learn more and stuff like that. And so maybe even getting some objective. I mean, does she have people at church who are mentors in her life? Does she have, you know, other people that know her well that, you know, you can kind of get to know her with and through and stuff could be helpful as well.
Exactly. And is she going in that direction, whether mm-hmm. she's there yet or not? Okay. I'm not as concerned about has she gotten there yet or not. Is she committed to going in that direction? Yeah. That would be important to me.
Yeah, good point. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for weighing in on that. Folks, that is it for this week's show. And so we will plan to see you around next week as we finish out the month of October and are fully into fall here. So have a great week, and we will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.
The seasons of your life are always moving forward. Singlehood, marriage, parenting, aging well. And through it all, Focus on the Family is alongside you with encouragement from a biblical perspective. And now we have a tool that gathers our trusted guidance and support together in one place, the enhanced Focus on the Family app. With it, you can listen to the Focus on the Family broadcast, engage our social media, find a counselor, or make a donation. All on the Focus on the Family app. Download it today from the App Store or Google Play.